Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The masthead to the Marion Star, the newspaper Warren Harding founded, included a journalistic template that could fairly be applied to most of life's circumstances. Remember, there are two sides to every question. Get them both. Be truthful. Get the facts. Be decent. Be fair. Be generous. It's sort of like everything you ever wanted to learn, you learned in kindergarten. The new book, The Harding Affair, Love and Espionage During the Great War, by author and lawyer James Robinault, suggests that there are more than two sides, even, and that perhaps more histories of our 29th president have been unfair to his memory. Harding died in office just before the news broke of the infamous Teapot Dome scandal. Well, I think he kind of maybe perhaps knew about it, but it was before the news broke, and his reputation seemed to stagnate at that point, but there were letters that told a different story. Several hundred love letters from Harding, the last Ohioan elected president, to his longtime mistress and Marion neighbor, Carrie Phillips. Jim, in his book, suggests that this previously hidden chapter in Harding's life might be the most important, and the story begins with how the letters that signify this period in his life were hidden from public view for decades. Joining me today is James Robinault. Thanks for being here, Jim.
Hi, Ann. Nice to talk to you.
And also by phone, former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Herbert Brown, who represented Harding's heirs, who in the 1970s wanted to seal the letters and succeeded. A Franklin County Common Pleas judge did so. They're supposed to be sealed until July 2014. Judge, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thanks for being here. Let's go back to the 70s first and find out more about these letters and how they came to light and what happened in the 70s. Jim?
Well, I'll start off, but Judge Brown is the one who lived it personally.
Right.
What happened is Carrie Phillips, who was the mistress, grew old and actually senile in Marion and was committed to a nursing home. And the lawyer representing her, a guy named Don Williamson, found the letters in a locked closet. And they were just a staggering number of pages, 900 pages collected. So he then hid them away for a number of years. And then when an author named Francis Russell came to Marion in 1963, right before the Kennedy assassination, those letters were given to this author, Francis Russell. He then took them to the Ohio Historical Society, and from there the Hardings found out of the existence of these letters, and they sued to seal them for 50 years, and that's where Judge Brown comes in.
So what happened back in the 70s, Judge?
Well, that, what Jim says is basically right. I think Mr. Russell used the Ohio Historical Society in order to persuade the attorney to turn the letters over, and that the quid pro quo for that was he had the exclusive right to look at them first. But they got leaked, and there were some earlier leaks that weren't so important, but the main one was when Johnny Apple, a main reporter for the New York Times, ran a story quoting one or two of these letters. The Harding family then consulted Vorys, Sater, Seymour, and Pease, the law firm I was partner of at the time, and we obtained a consent decree. The author of a letter, It's a literary property and has the common law copyright in that letter. That was our position. Ultimately, there were depositions taken, and to make a long story short, a consent decree was entered sealing the letters for 50 years.
What was the magic of 50 years at the time? Why was...
Well, I think the family has had some bad knocks, the Harding family. I don't think they really back then wanted to conceal the letters from history, but the feeling was that anyone that had emotional attachment to the president, and there were still some at the time, that passage of time would ease those concerns.
At that time, did Francis Russell know about the contents of the letters, or had he been able
yes.
to? Okay.
He had read them.
And Ann, let me just add here a couple things that I think Judge Brown would not be comfortable saying, being an advocate for the Hardings, but I can say it and not being their advocate.
Okay.
They're a great family, a wonderful family, and they sensed that Francis Russell was up to no good. And in fact, he was up to no good. He wanted to take these letters and just use the sensational parts of them, and they are very graphic at points and
yes,
really smear Harding. And one of the reasons he did is he believed this long-held rumor that the Hardings had African-American ancestors. And, in fact, he entitled his book The Shadow of Blooming Grove, referencing sort of that race rumor. And the Hardings knew what he was up to, so they felt like they had no choice but to go after him and then to seal these things because he really was a bad actor. His biography, it was a bestseller, and it helped further smear Harding's reputation. So they felt like they had no choice.
Judge, had you ever done anything like this before with this sort of historical documents?
Well, this case was unique. We did some research to find that you do have a common law copyright in the literary property of a writing. But, yeah, this was – I never had a case like this in my practice, if that's the question.
And also, it wasn't the property of the Harding family, the Harding heirs.
Well, yes, it would.
Okay.
It would devolve to them by the laws of inheritance.
Right. And one of the things, Ian, is that, you know, Florence Harding had died by then. She would have had those rights. So those rights went to his brother George and the rest of the family. And George was the named plaintiff in the case, who Judge Brown represented.
That's right.
So the Harding property, by virtue of the fact that he wrote the letters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, once you write a letter, you have a copyright in it. It's your writing, and nobody can use it without your permission, essentially, until a certain amount of time has passed after you've died. So that was essentially the theory here. It really sparked, as Judge Brown can tell you, a national debate about historical documents, historical figures, and whether or not they have this right, essentially, of privacy. The American Heritage Magazine, which is one of the great history magazines, got involved, and they did several editorials about this also. It was a big national debate at the time.
Judge, what other case did you look at to prepare for this?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember that.
Well, I expect something.
But it's been 40 years ago.
It really is.
I can't even remember cases I looked at a year ago.
Well, it
really is what we would call sui generis in our copyright law is copyright law.
But okay.
This question of someone who's been a president and what sort of rights they have and do those trump, you know, free speech, do they trump copyright, et cetera, really made it a very unique case. So it is a very
unique case. That certainly is true.
Judge, did you get a look at the letters that you were working to protect?
There's still, I believe, one of the copies is in the vault over at Voorhees, Sater, Seymour, and Peet.
Really?
I never went to look at them.
Well, really, and did you, but was there talk at the time of what they contained? Did you hear?
Yes, and I think Jim can tell you, he's read them and studied them a lot more about what's in them. I really wouldn't be an authority on that at all, except I knew they were lengthy and somewhat seamy.
Yeah. At times.
You know, actually, Anne, the letters themselves, you know, Harding really was in love with this woman. This was a 15-year relationship.
Yeah, that's true.
And he had a very, very strong attachment to her. And he talks about how his marriage lacked intimacy with mm-hmm. Florence Harding. And there are lots of reasons for that I don't think we want to go into. But in any event, he felt very free with her to express himself both sexually and emotionally, and that's why these letters are so unbelievable. I mean, it's unbelievable that we've got a president's, former president's letters, but these letters are real treasures in the sense that he really expresses himself. And sometimes he's very funny, and he, you know, sexually. Sometimes he's very serious about the nature of love. And of course, they then get into this major debate over the war and what should happen as a result of World War I breaking out,
and his own politics and whether he should be a politician or not.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real argument to make that she pushed him into politics because he thought he had lost her. She went off to Germany about 5 or 6 years into their relationship when she thought he would never leave his wife. And so she went to Berlin, Germany with her daughter to educate her there. And that's where she got indoctrinated into the German ethos and German Kultur. And, you know, she became a real German advocate. But he would not have run for Senate had he not thought that he had lost her. And so he runs in 1914 and wins, and 6 years later he's president of the United States.
And he runs pretty much. I mean, he had supporters who wanted him to run, but it was sort of to distract himself.
Yeah, it absolutely. He was he was very much depressed over losing her, and you know, over their inability to do anything with their relationship but keep it secret. And you know, he always said that when he was depressed, and he was depressed quite a bit, when he was depressed, he worked his way out of it. And so to him, getting involved in a campaign and the hubbub and everything else was something that really, you know, energized him and brought him his energy back. So he knew enough to do that when he felt as low as he felt as a result of all this.
There's one background, if I could put
sure,
into
Jeff.
That. And Jim's much more into this than I am, but I've done some reading on the Hardings. And when Florence Harding first heard about these letters, it was when Harding was considering running for governor, which he did do, and was defeated. But Carrie Phillips sent a letter to the Harding residence, and Mrs. Harding recognized the writing and opened it. And her first thought was to get a divorce. The background on that, as I understand it, and correct me, Jim, if I'm wrong, was that Carrie Phillips had been putting pressure on Harding to marry her. And at that point, she was opposed to his running for office because, of course, the divorce, if it went through, would affect him politically. At least that's my understanding.
Right.
And that may have that probably changed in the intervening years when she went to Germany.
Yeah.
And then he ran for Senate.
Yeah, she always opposed his political career because it would stand in between them. And again, the essence of this book is a real love affair. It just happens to play out against this fantastic, you know, world war and, you know, his rise to the presidency. But it really is amazing that these little things in life, you know, can affect world history. And this is clearly one of them. It's an amazing story.
Well, if it happened today, it'd be just steamy cell phone conversations, and it'd be lost forever.
Yeah, that's another big theme that people pick up when they read this is how people used to write letters. I mean, some of these letters are 40 pages long and very expressive. And we just don't have that today. We have three-line emails that we write.
How many letters were there in all?
Well,
I counted
a little over 110 letters, separate letters. But some of those letters, the ones that are 40 pages long, were written over several days. So he'd start a letter, and then he'd come back to it several days later.
Okay, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're going to take a quick break. I am speaking with a former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Herbert Brown. Judge, I don't know if you're going to be taking off after this or not. If you are, thanks for being with us.
It's up to you.
Okay, hang in there then. And also, James Robinault, he is the author of the new book about Harding. It is called The Harding Affair, Love and Espionage During the Great War. All Sides with Ann Fisher, WOSU 820. We'll be right back.
Support for WOSU comes from Thrifty Airport Valet Parking, a valet service for business and leisure travelers that takes you in your car to curbside check-in at Port Columbus, 614-237-5800 or thriftycolumbus.com.
And good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Support WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer today. WOSU is currently looking for a daytime volunteer to assist with the administration of the volunteer program. You must be computer proficient, and you may go through an application and interview process. For more information on this and other volunteer opportunities, visit us online at wosu.org/volunteers. In the weather forecast, currently 60 degrees in downtown Columbus, a wind advisory in effect until early Tuesday morning. Wind gusts could be as high as 45 miles per hour. Sunshine today, a slight chance of rain, and currently 60 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the new book about Warren G. Harding. It's called The Harding Affair, Love and Espionage During the Great War. It's by author and lawyer James Robinault. Jim, the letters were hidden for many years, presumably because they made clear his longtime love affair with Carrie Phillips. But you said in the prologue of your book that ironically they may be Harding's salvation. And the book winds up to that in the end. Why is that?
Yeah, I could have written about five books out of these letters.
Sure.
And who knows, I may write another one out of them. But Harding has been extremely, very poorly treated by history. He is, you know, routinely seen as one of the worst presidents in U.S. history. In point of fact, he was a very good president. He ended the war with Germany. He first arms limitation treaty, first office of the budget, pardoned Eugene Debs, went into Birmingham, Alabama, made a civil rights speech that was fantastic. A lot of good things on his ledger as a president. And yet he's been treated this way, in part, I think, because of the innuendo about his personal life. So once I read all these letters, I started to see the personal aspect to them and the fact that he really was, a good guy in a lot of ways. And so it's interesting that letters of adultery would be the things that I think should begin a renewal of a new look at him and a new look at what he did as president, too, without all this innuendo out there.
What drew you to the letters? Did you know what you would find? Did you already know what was in there and you just needed to use them to authenticate the argument, or?
Well, like Judge Brown, I'd read about these letters actually in Francis Russell's book. Francis Russell wrote, you know, The Shadow of Blooming Grove. It's one of the unique books in American history because it actually has redacted parts that are taken out where the letters were supposed to be because of this consent decree. And, of course, you read a lot more into those missing passages had it actually been there. So I knew about these letters. And then I put on a seminar here at Case in 2004 on Ohio and the presidency when they had the vice presidential debate here. And in doing so, the Western Reserve Historical Society here in Cleveland asked me to come over. They had just gotten a box, and in that box was a microfilm, and they said, here are the letters, you know, and it's a bootleg copy of them. And I looked through them, and I started to read them, and I started to see, boy, this is a bigger story than I thought. So I researched them and sent off Freedom of Information Act requests, and I ended up getting back this whole story of Kerry being watched as a German spy during the First World War. So that just exploded the book and exploded what I needed to write about.
Judge, how can this work there can be bootleg copies out there and they can be used when it had been sealed for another 5 years?
Well, of course, you know, we didn't know where all the copies were. There was sworn testimony in a deposition where they were, but people can lie. But the consent decree was against individuals. And Jim did the exact right thing when he discovered these letters. He went to the Harding family and got consent to use these letters, as I understand it, because even though the injunction or the consent decree might not have covered the party that had this bootleg copy, any new person would be in exactly the same position that Francis Russell was or Duckett when they got the letters. I mean, the common law copyright still existed, and I don't know what the family would have done, but you could have been subject to a lawsuit. So he did the right thing.
Okay, that's former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Herbert Brown. He represented the Harding heirs in the 1970s when they sought to seal the letters and succeeded, sort of. Franklin County Common Pleas Judge sealed them until 2014. Author and lawyer James Robinault got a bootleg copy and wrote a book about it. Thanks a lot for being with us, Judge.
Okay.
Take care.
Goodbye.
Jim, you got a hold of the letters. You saw that there was a story there. You found out about, from public information request, found out about Kerry and her the alleged spying.
Right.
What kind of conclusion? How did you come to your conclusion, and what kind of conclusion did you come to about that?
Well, first of all, as a lawyer, I know a little bit about gathering evidence and weighing evidence and looking at sources and credibility issues and those sorts of things. So what I tried to do when I wrote this book is write it in such a way that the reader is given, their own ability to read the evidence directly and then make their own conclusions. I have my own conclusion. I'll tell you what it is, and I'll tell you the evidence it's based on. But I really have written the book so that people can read it and kind of stew about it and come to their own conclusions. And what I concluded after looking at all the evidence was it's a very strong case that Carrie Phillips and her daughter were, in fact, acting as agents for the German government during the First World War. And briefly, the evidence is this. First of all, when we got into the First World War, we hadn't been in, it had been going for 3 years before we got involved. We were not ready to get involved in that war. And most Americans really didn't want to get involved in the European War. So as a result, we were scrambling in the summer of 1917 to put together training camps to train a million men to go over to France to fight. Well, the Germans wanted to know how long it was going to take the Americans to get into the fight. And so they needed people in the United States to sit outside these camps and fraternize with the officers to find out, you know, how are things going, when are ships going to leave, what's your projection, that sort of thing. And that's exactly what I think Carrie Phillips and her daughter did at a camp just outside of New York City called Camp Upton in the middle of Long Island. So they were there for 6 weeks at the end of the summer of 1917. And, you know, what are two women from Marion, Ohio doing outside of a camp?
In a little cottage. I mean, it wasn't like they were vacationing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
It didn't make any sense.
What's interesting about these letters is Harding actually writes to her when she's there, and he believes she's on vacation. But I think she was fooling him at that time. He then finds out in 1918 through government agents that I think visit him and tell him that she has been watched because she was, you know, sitting outside this camp for so long. And he writes her and says, you know, of course I know you're not a German spy, but whatever you're doing, stop it and knock it off. But it's pretty clear to me that they were involved in helping to get that intelligence back to Germany. The other story that I tell in the book, the story within the story.
The Baroness.
The Baroness. There's a family in New York City called the Pickharts. And the Pickharts were a very wealthy German-American family. They imported dyes that people used to in the textile industry for, you know, clothes, coloring, that sort of stuff. Germany was way ahead of everybody else on these synthetic dyes. And in any event, this family had very big German connections, and one of the daughters actually goes over to Germany and marries a baron, and therefore she becomes a baroness. She eventually divorces him, but not after being in the inner circle of Kaiser Wilhelm. And, you know, going to court balls and meeting the Kaiser and all that sort of stuff. She comes back to the U.S., and one of the people that Carrie Phillips interacts with is the Pickhardt family, and I believe the Baroness, too. Isabel Phillips, who is Carrie's daughter, gets engaged to Adolf Pickhardt, who is the cousin of the Baroness. So there, and then, of course, as you know from looking at the book, the Baroness herself gets arrested outside of a camp down in Georgia, where she's sleeping with a army officer who's half her age, and she's then, you know, brought up on charges of espionage.
Yeah, all kinds of tackiness going on. It's just a lot of tacky, seamy details. But the way you juxtapose her story, which occurs largely during testimony in a hearing.
Right.
What was that hearing exactly for?
Well, whenever you're arrested on a criminal charge, you have a probable cause hearing to determine whether or not there's enough evidence to hold you over for a trial. And so she was arrested in December of 1917 in this hotel, and she had on her a code in which the officer was going to say, if I write all's well at the end of a letter, that means that we're going from Norfolk. If not, we're going from New York City. I mean, it's clearly a code to talk about when ships are going to go. And, you know, the German submarines are out there sinking ships as they cross. So clearly very incriminating evidence against her. And she is put in this probable cause hearing. And so there's 3 days of testimony where they put on all the evidence. And a magistrate decides in that at the end of that testimony that there is sufficient evidence to hold her for espionage. One of the great historical mysteries, and there are several that I raise in this book, is why didn't she come to a full jury trial? She was allowed to go back to New York City on bail, and I think I have an answer to it, but I'm not sure. But it also is kind of an explosive answer.
This probable cause hearing, is that sort of like a grand jury?
Yeah.
Usually they'd be secret.
Yeah. The probable cause hearing is like a grand jury in the sense that you're looking at the evidence that the prosecution has. In this case, though, it was almost like a mini trial because they allowed the lawyers both on the prosecutor's side and her lawyer to question witnesses and put on witnesses. And she, the Baroness, took the stand for about 9 hours. So there's a lot of testimony, and she had this fantastic life, so it makes for a very interesting story.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I am speaking with James Robinault. He is the author of The Harding Affair, Love and Espionage During the Great War, a story made possible by the disclosure of hundreds of letters and hundreds of pages of letters, certainly about 900 pages, from Warren G. Harding to his mistress, Carrie Phillips. The affair lasted about 12 years?
Well, it starts in 1905.
Okay.
And they have an anniversary date, August 23, that they celebrate. That would have been a Wednesday in 1905. And it really falls apart when he runs for president. She's finally totally exasperated with him. And the letters, the last letters, show that she blackmailed him when he ran for president and asked for money. And so the whole thing falls apart, although there is evidence that they might have seen each other while he was in the presidency. But it was kind of a sad ending, in the sense that both of them, truly both of them, they were each other's love of the life, you know. I mean, she was his love of his life and likewise. So, I think it just, they both were in circumstances where they were in marriages that were unhappy marriages and they couldn't get out of them. And he, by circumstance, you know, ends up running for president of the United States. And the whole thing falls apart. So it's really a 15-year relationship.
Let's go back a little bit to your reference to Francis Russell's book that made the allegations, or that there was this shadow. Well, it's called The Shadow of Blooming Grove, but the shadow over the book was that it accused him of mixed blood relations way back when. How would those letters shed any light on that topic or create any confusion?
Well, what happens is, and this is American racism, and it's as vile as it gets. Our country's been infected with it from its birth, you know, and even before its birth, obviously, with slavery. And what happens is Francis Russell wants to write a book about Harding, and he wants to smear him. So he's looking for evidence. And the main thing he's after is this African-American ancestor. Of course, today we have Barack Obama as president, and, you know, it's a great thing to have mixed blood. It's, you know, it's something that people see diversity today. And in the past, it was a horrible, shameful thing to think of this. But in any event, that's what he was looking for. He was looking to smear him through this race rumor. The Hardings will tell you that they were abolitionists, and therefore people started saying, well, you must have black ancestors. Mm-hmm. You know, just I don't believe that he did have a black ancestor. My position is, great if he did, but I don't think that's true. But in any event, Russell wanted to smear him. But Russell was looking for evidence, as other people did. A lot of biographers of Harding fell into this. They were looking for evidence of what they considered, you know, black traits. And one of them is being oversexed, and one of them is being stupid, and one of them is being illiterate, and all these sorts of things that, you know, the horrible racial stereotypes. And so Russell thought that these letters fit in with that stereotype, and that the whole thing was further proof to him that Harding had African ancestors. And if you read some of his letters, it's really vile stuff. And this guy was a Harvard law professor, you know, and a noted historian.
Very credible.
Yeah. So and I got to tell you, Ann, if you go on Amazon.com and look at the reviews of my book, they allow readers to review the book. There's a guy on there called, he goes by Dr. Watson, and he believes the Harding rumors. He gives he trashes the book, but if you look at all the other reviews he's done online, he says things like, everybody knows Warren Harding was an octoroon, and, you know, he attacks any book that would tend to want to rehabilitate him. So this racism is alive and well, surprisingly to me. But, you know, it's just so, it's awful stuff, and it has affected, you know, the way history has been written about Warren Harding in a very quiet but very persistent way.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you really only mentioned the racial issues in the prologue and then John Dean in his foreword,
right?
The book otherwise ignores it, and thereby it is criticized by folks who think this is a big issue.
Yeah.
Okay.
And my feeling about that was that I was going to reference the fact of who Russell was and when he got these letters and what he was all about. And I originally planned on writing a full third of the book on it. It would have just made the book unwieldy and too big. And so I've decided I'll either do that in some journal or perhaps even write another book. But it is a book unto itself, actually. And in this book, the real emphasis became this love relationship, what it meant, and really the whole reasons for the United States being involved in the First World War and what impact this relationship had on world history.
And I want to get to that after our break. But before that, again, going backwards a little bit with the Baroness, how did you decide, when did you come to the decision that this would make an interesting literary foil?
Well, you know, I sent out, as a lawyer, I know how to do this, and a lot of authors know how to do that these days. There's something called the Freedom of Information Act, and you can send out those FOIA requests, as they're called.
Right.
And I sent them out, and when I got back this one that had 18 pages of these Bureau of Investigation agents following around Carrie Phillips and her husband and her daughter and getting into cabs with them in Cincinnati and so forth, I thought, what a story. But then I realized that this connected, and the whole investigation started because the Baroness was arrested in Chattanooga, Tennessee in December of 1917, and a local postmaster in Marion, Ohio, who was intercepting mail in his little town and reading it.
Which was very common back then,
before they got
into the war, yeah.
Yeah, so this guy connected up. He knew that a guy named Pickhart had been engaged to Carrie Phillips' daughter, and he was watching the Phillipses himself, and then he sees that a Baroness whose maiden name is Pickhart is arrested. And so he puts two and two together and starts this investigation that results in that file that I ended up finding through this Freedom of Information Act request.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. I'm speaking with Cleveland area lawyer James Robinault. He's the author of a new book about our 29th president, Warren G. Harding. Jim believes that Harding may have gotten a bad rap over the years. What do you think? Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
During the 8 years that Bill Clinton was president of the United States, he secretly recorded interviews with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch. On the next Fresh Air, Taylor Branch joins us to talk about his new book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurovich. Get more radio. The WOSU Fall Membership Drive begins soon, and you can help reduce the number of days. For every $20,000 we raise before the drive begins, we'll take one day off of the drive. Visit WOSU.org/pledgefree for details. Watch the story of a young president, Theodore Roosevelt, become one of the National Park's greatest champions. A magnificent species rescued from extinction in Yellowstone and John Muir's fight to save a beautiful valley. Watch Ken Burns' The National Parks, America's Best Idea, tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. And for complete listings of the six-part series, visit WOSU.org. A wind advisory is in effect until 2 o'clock Tuesday morning, when gusts could be as high as 45 miles per hour. A little sunshine today and a chance of rain. Steady temperatures in the 60s, currently 60 degrees. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with James Robinault. He is the author of The Harding Affair, Love and Espionage During the Great War. And a major theme in the book, Jim, is how history might be different if it hadn't been for this affair.
Right, right.
Tell me how.
Well, I think there are two big headlines from this book. The first is that she convinced him not to run for president in 1916. And I think the letters pretty well establish that. So that's one big headline story. And the other one is, of course, the one that we've talked about, which is that she became a German spy. And did that impact the way he, you know, voted for war or how he conducted his presidency? So let me start with the first one, which I think is actually the most important one. In 1916, Woodrow Wilson was running for reelection, and he barely won the presidency 4 years earlier because the Republicans split in two when Teddy Roosevelt formed the Bull Moose Party and ran against his successor, William Howard Taft, another Ohioan. That really tore apart the Republican Party, and therefore the Democrats got in. Wilson did not believe that he had a great chance to win re-election. In fact, he had a plan in place to resign right after the election so that the transition of power could happen more quickly. So it was a really nebulous situation. The Republicans in 1916 nominated Charles Evans Hughes as their nominee. You would not know who he is. He ended up becoming Harding's Secretary of State. He was actually a very, very intelligent man, but he was a poor campaigner. Teddy Roosevelt called him the bearded iceberg. He had a beard. But in any event, he barely lost to Wilson. It took days for them to figure out what was going to happen. But he lost Ohio by a very large majority, and Harding would have taken Ohio and therefore would have been the president. He clearly could have defeated Wilson. I believe he would have defeated Wilson. Then he would have been our war president, which leads, I think, to two big questions. First, would we have gotten involved in the war to begin with? Did we need to? And secondly, what would Versailles and what would the peace treaty have been like had Harding gone over the conciliator and also the guy who includes everyone, as opposed to Wilson, who excluded everyone and did it on his own? And as you know, that the League of Nations went down to defeat in the Senate and so forth. So I think it had, had Versailles not been so harsh, had there been more of an equal peace treaty, you may not have had Adolf Hitler. You may not have had a lot of things that happened. You know, the Bolsheviks in Russia. I mean, world history was truly influenced by that election and by what happened there and by Warren Harding not running.
And maybe the woman behind it.
Yes.
You mentioned he's a conciliator. He was very inclusive. These are some of the qualities you thought that made him a great president.
Yeah. History has so badly treated this guy. It's ridiculous. He was truly presidential material when he was in the Senate. He did a lot of great things. And the best indicator of that is that when Teddy Roosevelt dies unexpectedly in January of 1919, the Republicans immediately start looking around, who's going to be our candidate? And universally, they say Warren Harding. And that is the people who are in the Senate and in the Congress who we worked with. They look to him as the guy. That says a lot, because that's no PR campaign. You know, Roosevelt has just died. They're looking for who would be their leader, and they pick Warren Harding. And that's much different from historians who said he was a no-good senator, didn't do anything, and got to power through a back deal, smoke-filled room. That just didn't happen. That wasn't the case. He was a very, very skillful politician, and he had a lot of great qualities in that area.
He did go along with the Republican machine, however. He wasn't independent. He was pretty entrenched, wasn't he?
Well, here's the thing. In American history, you've got two ways of looking at government. One is that we have a representative democracy, that we truly have a republic where we elect our representatives and they represent us. And the best way that people over the years have believed that we can do that is through the party system. So he was a big believer in the party system. And he did not believe, for example, in what Teddy Roosevelt did, which is, individually, I'm the person, it really is the party, it's not the person. So he truly believed that that was an American tradition that was important to continue, and that that's how our government functioned best. So he was very much a party person as opposed to an individual person. And there are arguments to be made that Teddy Roosevelt really almost wrecked the Republican Party because he was the opposite.
But it was kind of interesting in the book. I'm no Harding scholar, obviously, but the point during the war, I think it was during the war, that he suggested that the United States needed a dictator because that's the only way the war could be run efficiently.
Yeah.
Fought efficiently.
Yeah,
that was kind of bizarre.
It was one of those things where he had gotten out. He opposed Woodrow Wilson's idea that we should make the world a democracy. And it's a very current topic right now. Do we go out and change other governments? We see it playing out in Iraq right now.
Yes.
Is that our business, or is it our business to take care of ourselves? He believed that we should not be going out trying to make the world a democracy, and he spoke out against it and said we shouldn't be doing this. And in some ways, he was right. Russia became a democracy, and then the Bolsheviks came along 6 months later. Germany became a democracy, and the Nazis came along. So there was a lot to be said for the wisdom of that. But he also found that it is a bad thing to criticize a president during wartime. So he not only backed away, but he went too far and said we should really give somebody dictatorial powers so that they can get us into this war and get it over with quickly. And he said that because he was so frustrated with the way the senators at the time were getting up and speaking against things and filibustering and so forth. He just thought this is no way to run a war, you know. And he pointed to Abraham Lincoln essentially becoming a dictator during the Civil War and said that, you know, that's the way it ended up being there and we can get it done quicker.
And he believed thoroughly in the system that it would go revert back, no problem.
Yeah, he had a very interesting – he said, you know, Germany, who wears autocracy like the flesh on its bones, we just pick it up and put it on as a cloak, and then we can discard it as soon as we don't need it anymore. And he said, we've done that in American history, and we should do it again now because it really was – we barely got into that war, and we really had minimal impact at the end because we just weren't ready, and we were very disorganized, spent a ton of money, and, you know, it was – there was something to be said for the inefficiency that was going on at that point.
And I may be wrong, but I think the pandemic of 1918 started in a military fort.
Yeah, I mentioned that later on in the book.
Speaking of changing history.
Yeah, I mean, that's another question. A lot of people take it back to some fort. One of these forts I talked about that they put together for, you know, putting the million-man army together was in Kansas, and they believed that horrible flu that arose could be traced back there, and of course, then we take it overseas, and then, you know, tens of millions of people die as a result of that. So, you do talk about fateful consequences to decisions. You see it play out all the time, and people who don't read their history or know their history have it repeated over and over again.
Yeah, Chapter 8 consists solely of one impassioned paragraph from a letter, which I imagine was much longer, that Warren Harding wrote to Carrie Phillips on Christmas Eve 1910. And I noticed as I read through the book that you had several chapters that were maybe a page long or just a paragraph long. And in this particular case, it was just an excerpt.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that? What made you do that?
Well, there were a couple things that I just thought were worth emphasizing because, you know, this book is essentially about the letters at the end of the day. And so twice I have two chapters where I just take his letters and excerpt them. Again, it's part of my being a lawyer and letting people just see the evidence. It's so much more powerful to me to just see what he wrote and how he wrote and how, you know, what his expressions were rather than reading somebody telling you about it. But at the same time, you know, it would be a 900-page book if I just quoted all the letters. So I did that twice. I also did it with the telegram that was sent by the German ambassador, the Zimmerman note is what it was called, because that was the real turning point in our getting involved in that war. And I'd read about it over time, but when I finally saw the telegram itself, I thought, this is unbelievable, and it's no wonder we got into the war. So I just thought it was really worth emphasizing and making it one chapter, and so the reader can actually see the evidence directly.
And I appreciate the end. It was footnoted at the end of the book. I'm the type that sits and reads footnotes. I'd never get through the book, and also a very nice index as well. By chapter 13, I'm really wishing I could read what Carrie had written to Harding. I'm not sure why it happened in that chapter, but I wondered about, he did ask her to destroy the letters he sent her. Did he routinely destroy her correspondence?
No. Well,
do we know?
Yeah, he writes about it. He did. He would save them from time to time and then destroy them. There was one night in the Senate when he thought he wasn't feeling well one night. He writes about how he went late one night to his Senate office and actually destroyed all her letters so they wouldn't be found because he was worried he was ill in some way, and should he suddenly pass away, he didn't want these to be found. So he did destroy them. But I agree with you 1,000%. It's, in fact, how I end the book. I write that it's just frustrating that we can't hear her voice in all this. We only hear her in the reflection through what he writes.
Right.
And they also get into a lot of wrangling as they get into the war. And, you know, I know that he must have loved her because she was a very loving person. The people in Marion, when I launched the book there, some of the older residents remembered her, and they remember her as being kind of quirky and funny and very large personality. And I'm sure she was a very large personality. She comes off as very shrewish in this book because they're fighting so much about the war. But I don't think that was her essential personality. I think he loved her because she was a woman who was interested in the world and, you know, went to Europe with her daughter for 3 years. I mean, she was a very dynamic person. And it's really a shame that we couldn't hear her voice in all of this.
Assuming that you're accurate about her being – about Carrie Phillips being a spy, do you think that's why she came back in the first place?
No, I don't think so, but it's possible because he was running for Senate at that time, and he hadn't yet won the the Senate seat. So she comes back in the summer, just as August 1914 happens, right as the Guns of August, you know,
right,
start up in Europe. And people thought that war was going to be very small, you know, very short term. So I'm not so sure that she was sent back, but clearly she gets involved in spying, as did a lot of Americans who had a very mixed feeling about whether we should be pro-British and pro-French and pro-ally in this whole thing. Everybody was at fault in the First World War. It was very different from the Second World War, where it's black and white, good and evil. In the First World War, everybody was at fault, and there were a lot of German Americans. 20% of our population was of German heritage, and you know, felt loyalty to their country and thought we shouldn't be fighting them. It's a very mixed story, and that's something I didn't know about until I researched this book and wrote about it.
You did find in the among the letters notes from her,
right?
Not to him, but notes to herself.
Right.
What, and that is really the most voice you can get in terms of authenticity.
Yes. She had very, very difficult handwriting. I had to spend years transcribing not only his letters but her notes, which were very difficult to read. But eventually you do. And then you got to date them, because she didn't sit there and date them, you know, by and there are ways to date them by what she's talking about in the notes.
Mm-hmm.
But she, I think she wrote a lot of notes as she was thinking about how to respond to him, especially on war issues. And so these notes are mostly political and mostly about, you know, the United States being hypocritical. For example, she says in one of her notes, you know, this is a war to make the world safe for democracy. You know, Wilson's quite a freedom fighter when we have a Negro man lynched in the South yesterday. So she looked at it from a very different political standpoint, but thought that Wilson was being very hypocritical. And, of course, Wilson was quite a racist in his day. But so, yeah, her notes help a little bit, but it would be nice to have more of her letters.
If you can just, you know, just as a reader extrapolating from what wasn't said, which is what her letters were, I get the feeling that she often used the letter writing more, not quite as romantically as he did. It was more about issues.
Yeah, he was very effusive, and he was a very tender guy, and he really loved her. I mean, you can just tell.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, he really loved her, and she really loved him, but she also, I think, felt the need to manipulate him through these letters because she just didn't have any leverage with him, and she kept seeing him getting involved in politics and not leaving his wife. And you know, one of the main reasons he didn't leave his wife is she was very ill. She had a very bad kidney and was sick a lot, very sick, you know, like he was told regularly she would die. I believe he thought she would die and that would solve the issue. And so Carrie, I think, used these to manipulate him and to, you'll see later on where she starts talking about other men to
yes,
kind of get his jealousy up too. But I think it's, on her part, it's just kind of a desperation that she really felt like he didn't keep his promises to her and, you know, that she was lashing back at him.
When they started to realize that their spouses probably suspected something and were making remarks here and there, they started up what I guess they kind of gave new meaning to the phrase cover letter. They started sending, when they would mail each other's letters, they would actually have a cover letter in there that they could then hand to their spouse and say, oh, this is what they wrote me this week.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a couple different devices they used. One was that cover letter that you're talking about. They called it an open letter.
Yes.
So the first five pages would be, you know, how's it going, what's happening in Marion, that sort of thing, or what's happening in Germany. And then the last 20 pages would be the really steamy stuff.
And would they have a fake ending to it?
They would stop, yeah. After the five pages, they would give a signature and then go on to the next pages, which so you'll see these open letters ending so that they could actually show it to their spouse, or in Carrie's case, when she was in Berlin, show it to her daughter, you know, to say, oh, Warren wrote me again, here's his letter. They also had a code when she went to Germany that I almost called this the Harding Code, because
yeah,
it's a code of these various terms that if he wrote them in a cable, a public cable, or a public open letter and underlined them, they would have certain meanings, you know, like I love you more than all the world, if he used constant, for example,
mm-hmm,
and underlined it. So there was a whole three-page code that he put together when she went to Germany so he could write her cables and open letters.
How did you decide which letters to quote from? Because there was hundreds of pages, and you don't quote constantly by any means.
Yeah, you know, that was the most difficult part, because there's so many beautiful passages. There's so many revealing passages. Quite frankly, there are a lot more graphic passages than I tried to downplay that because, you know, he was being very personal in some of these things. But I still do quote quite a bit. And, it was hard to figure out what to do. On the other hand, 900 pages of love letters, after a while, some of it gets quite repetitive. And he used to joke about that,
yes,
too.
And it did.
Nobody would want to read a book that had 900 pages of the same thing over and over. So that helped me kind of skinny it down. And then the world history implications of it became so important that I really had to dig in and really do my research on all of that and tell that story.
Did you work alone on that, or did you have help?
I worked pretty much alone. My great benefactor in all this is John Dean, the former White House counsel for Nixon. He was one of the guys that came to that seminar that I did in 2004 for the vice presidential debate because he wrote a book on Harding. Mm-hmm. He actually grew up in Marion. So he was the guy that I would bounce everything off and who I would talk to about all this stuff. He's very prolific author, and he writes a lot. He obviously is a part of history, but knows a lot about history, too, and knows a lot about the Harding story. So he and I worked together very closely, and he was very, very helpful to me. Almost on a daily basis, we would email or call or talk about it.
This probably isn't fair to ask because we only have a few minutes left, but you said earlier that you could probably have written 5 books from all of these letters.
Yeah.
What other ideas did you have?
Well, you know, the one John has done a book on Harding and his presidency. It's a short book. I think more needs to be done about his presidency. Everybody remembers Teapot Dome. Mm-hmm. Nobody remembers Birmingham, Alabama. And that's wrong. And it's not what we should be doing with our history.
Tell that story. That is interesting.
Yeah, well, in 1921, back then, all of the African Americans in the South were Republicans. They were all one party. Remember, Lincoln was the Republican. And he went down and said to this group in Birmingham, Alabama, you should be both Democrats and Republicans. And by the way, you guys, all you white people here on one side of the fence, and there were 100,000 people in this square, you guys, if blacks are not afforded political equality, democracy is a lie. And he got booed by all the whites and cheered by the blacks, again, separated by a chain link fence, 100,000 people in this scene in Birmingham, Alabama. And, you know, it was a very courageous thing for him to do. And again, people associate Warren Harding with Teapot Dome. They don't associate him with Birmingham, Alabama. It was a very courageous speech. He got kind of taken to task by the New York Times and other papers for doing that. But he did the right thing, and he should be remembered in history correctly for doing that thing.
You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guest today. There's more to all of this, and if you want to read about it, you can look at James Robinault's book, The Harding Affair, Love and Espionage During the Great War. That's what we've been talking about today, about Warren G. Harding. Jim, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm going to be at the Ohio Historical Society on October 11th. It's a Sunday at 2 p.m. to talk more about this, and Judge Brown will be there too.
Okay, great. Thank you for mentioning that. Again, All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.